and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast for February 25th. It's brought to you by Shooters in Nagoya. I'm John Gibson, and with me from lovely Osaka is Jim Allen. What's happening, bud?
Well, Osaka is lovely, but looking out my window here, I can't see that part.
You mean the cloud cover is too thick? Or your curtains?
No, the windows aren't clean?
The curtains?
The hotel's lovely. I've got a nice view of an expressway and a big main drag here. Had Bo Suzuka here, you know, motorcycle gangs going up and down the street last night. But anyway, it is good to be in Osaka because Japan is in Osaka, which sounds counterintuitive.
Right.
But Japan is in Osaka, and so is Australia. Is also in Osaka, and starting tomorrow, Cuba will be here, and Brazil will be here, and China will be here. So we're getting ready for the World Baseball Classic.
All right. Well, today's show, we're going to talk about the World Baseball Classic after an interview with Trey Hillman, and then we're going to discuss some of the guys who are in the major leagues. So let's get started.
Clearing the bases.
All right. Well, we are very pleased that Trey Hillman, the bench coach for the Los Angeles Dodgers, took time out of his busy schedule to sit down and talk with us just before he left for training camp. He's entering his third season with the Dodgers, and in this position, you know, he's a step away from being the skipper. So if something were to happen, and, you know, I'm not wishing any ill will on anyone because, you know, I'm rooting for my Dodgers and everything, but if something were to happen, you know, that would mean Trey Hillman could step in and be the manager, and how much would I love that?
He's a heartbeat away from he's a heart attack away from being manager. Oh, that's sad. I'm sorry. You shouldn't even have brought it up.
I didn't say anything about heart attacks or any ill will on anyone.
No,
I just mentioned where Trey was.
Okay. Don Mattingly is
the best
still
of health to you, Don Mattingly, the best of health to you, my friend.
Indeed.
All right. Well, Trey, we know him well. He spent 5 years in Japan. He guided the Fighters to back-to-back Japan Series appearances. I believe they were in the playoffs 3 times in 5 seasons in Japan. And he left and he went to the Kansas City Royals. And it's a shame he's not there now because the Royals have a lot of talent. And I think they're going to be fairly decent. I mean, they were fairly decent last year, but I think they're going to make a lot more noise this year.
Yeah, I mean, when I spoke to Trey a little more than a year, 2 years ago, a little less than 2 years ago, I said, you know, it's kind of sad because you had to hold the fort before until the cavalry got there, and it didn't arrive until after they said go someplace else.
Yeah, he was 152 and 207 with Kansas City, so he lost his gig there. But he's in a great place. He's with the Dodgers, and they have a lot of talent, and they have a lot of pressure because they have so much talent. But I think they're expected to win, and that could be why he said something at the end of the interview that he said. But I think he's in a good place. I think he's going to do well. I think the Dodgers are going to do well. It's too bad they couldn't make it happen after those big trades last season. But I think
it wasn't too bad.
Says the Giants fan.
Exactly. You'll have to the listeners will have to understand, you know, there's an interesting dynamic when your best friend, when you grow up hating the Dodgers with a really unrivaled passion, and your best friend is a Dodgers fan, you know, you kind of got to grow up. so we're growing up a lot.
Oh, well, I grew up a long time ago, but I've been forced to grow up since 1988. I mean, that was the last time I could be a kid.
You'll have to make it on your own without the Dodgers to help you.
Right. Anyway, we usually have interview issues like background sounds and what have you, wind. But in this case, there's some beeping that goes on and a human's dog sounds off. It's all on his side. So put that aside and let's give the Trey Hillman chat a listen here. All right. It's our privilege to be joined this week by Trey Hillman. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
John, you're welcome. It's good to see you again.
Good to see you again, but I still wear my T-shirt that you gave me from the 2006 Japan Series. I wear it with pride.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. A lot of great memories back in our 5 years in Japan, no doubt.
All right. Well, let's get started by talking about Kensuke Tanaka. Now, he's on a team that pretty much is set at second base. What abilities does he have, in your opinion, that could get him on the field with the Giants?
Well, I think the first thing he has is the ability to be open-minded with his versatility. This has been something that has been on his mind for a long time. I know even back after my first year or second year, I knew that it was his desire to eventually one day play in the United States. And I stay in touch with Ken Iwamoto, who was my interpreter over there. We stay in close contact. And I knew that Kensuke's desire was to come out. I think it's his open-mindedness. And as you well know, John, and guys coming over there to Japan, it's the same for guys coming from Japan to over here. If they're ready, willing, and able to adapt, and there's some athleticism that go with that, then they have a chance to perform and be a productive part of an organization.
What about talent-wise? What does he have that really can get him through?
He's got hand speed with the bat, and he has adaptability, for lack of a better term, with the barrel. The one thing that I remember about Kensuke is he was one of our better hitters at being able to manipulate the barrel, especially on split finger pitches down low that were dipping out down and out of the zone. But he found a way to get the barrel on the ball. And that is always a key component at the major league level to go along with his hand speed. From the left side is also an advantage for him because it plays into his other best tool for me, and that's his speed. So even though the Giants roster coming out of spring training, going into spring training, it looks like coming out, if everybody stays healthy, that it will be set from the championship club of last year, I don't think that should diminish his hopes because everyone inevitably has unforeseen injuries that can happen, and you just have to be ready to take advantage of those opportunities.
The Dodgers had a big injury at second base last year, and were they interested in him, do you think? Do you know?
I think there was some peripheral interest, but I think after the Dodgers made the decision to go ahead and sign Skip Schumacher, mm-hmm. I think, you know, we were looking for someone that could be a little bit of a security blanket for Matt Kemp in center, although we do still have Tony Gwynn available. But we were looking for more of a security blanket even behind Tony for center field. And then with Mark Ellis's right-on-right numbers in his history right-on-right, he hits left-handers better than he does right-handers. And Skip Schumacher is just the opposite. So once we signed Skip Schumacher as a left-handed bat that played second and center field, I think that probably took us off the Kensuke course.
All right. All right, now let's talk about you, Darvish. I predicted that he would win a lot of games last season in his first year with the Texas Rangers, basically because the Rangers scored a lot of runs. I knew it was going to be his first year, and there were going to be a lot of things for him to get used to, but I thought he'd be able to win. I actually predicted 16-17 wins, so I was happy that I got that right, but not to brag on myself. What were your expectations for him last year, and what do you see him doing this season?
Well, you know, with all the interviews that you can imagine that I did with Japanese writers and him coming to the United States, they all want that number. And I've always had a difficult time with predicting that number, and you actually outpredicted me because when I had to come up with a number, we were very close, but I came up with 15. And I think that he did exceptionally well for a starting pitcher, especially at his youth. You know, I look at you, and for me, he's a veteran guy, but he's still so young, and he's still in the prime of his career, and the Rangers will most probably have him throughout the prime of his career. Knowing what type of competitor he is, I think he's only going to continue to get better. The question mark for me, John, was how he would do in that ballpark because of what you said. That team scores a lot of runs, but one of the reasons they score a lot of runs is because it's an offensive, very offensive, productive, and conducive ballpark there in Arlington. So I think as he learns the league, learns to study better, fine-tune exactly what he did this year, I think he's just going to continue to get better and better. I still think he's a legitimate number one in their rotation at some point.
Yeah, I know wins are so hard to predict, and you don't know how many innings a guy is going to pitch and who's going to come in after and what's going to happen, and there's so many factors. So what kind of adjustments is he going to have to make in terms of the league getting to know him a little bit better?
I think the biggest adjustment, I just put myself in his shoes when I came to Japan. My first year with only 12 teams, it was so fast. Really, my first year in Japan was like a blur. I would think that with 162 games, so many more teams, so many more hitters to study, I would think that last year, at some point, he'll look back on it, and maybe he already is, and say, wow, it was a blur. I just think the fact that he's used to the culture, used to the numbers, and this year will more probably have the ability to slow it down, just from the number standpoint, you know, the number of competitors that he's going to be facing. So I think that's going to help him fine-tune his study habits and how he prepares for pitching in a specific game against a specific opponent. And it's also going to help him learn his teammates and what his comfort zone is with the guys that are returning with the Rangers.
Excellent. All right, now the Fighters, I want to turn to Japanese baseball here. The Fighters won the league last year, and they acquired the top rookie prospect in Shohei Ohtani. Is there something about the organization in particular that makes it successful?
You know, I say this with all humility because I was only a part of it, but I do believe that the system that we put in place, that the Fighters allowed for us to put in place, and again, I want to give credit where credit's due. The infrastructure there of my original general manager and president and Tak Kojima and Misawa-san allowing us to mix Western and Japanese ideas, have a little bit more of an open mind in comparison to the other Japanese clubs as far as facilitating trades, how we worked, how we developed a system of judging what we were going to need in upcoming years through the draft, having an opportunity to meet with the scouting department and help them fine-tune the difference between projectable performance on the mound and now pitchability, because you only have the one minor league team and you can actually get guys to get to the big leagues quicker and help the team quicker. Those are all components that they're still utilizing. They're utilizing a flow chart of how to continue to target what they're going to need 2 years out, 3 years out. I think that's one of the things that has helped them stay productive. The people that are in the front office now, the people that have consistently been, regardless of whether the titles have changed, Iwamoto-san is a key component for me, who was, as my interpreter, I don't even know his title now, but I know it's higher than that. Okoso-san, the acting owner when I was there, his vision and his drive for expertise. Shimada-san has been a consistent mainstay, and he was one of the primary reasons I got brought to Japan. And then Yoshimura-san, who is largely in charge of all the baseball ops. He's a brilliant guy that worked in the United States and kind of was an add-on after I'd already been there for a couple of years. He came on the last couple of years. He had worked in the United States with the Detroit Tigers. So I think, honestly, I think all those factors, along with the job that Oshima and Okudayama have done running the team, you know, they've been in the playoffs 4 out of the last 5 years since I've been gone. So I think that it's an infrastructure that will stand for many years, I hope.
Is there specific philosophy in terms of what kind of players, position players and pitchers that the team goes looks to bring in during the draft?
Well, you know what? I can't tell you about now. If they still have the same philosophy that we had while I was there, it was let's go get the best available athletes that we can that we know can eventually fit what the immediate needs of the organization are. And I kind of gave them a ratio, and I don't know that they went with this because I told them I didn't want the keys to everything. I just wanted to be available to give my opinions. But with the scouting department, I gave them like a 3-to-1 ratio on now pitchability to projectable pitchability on pitchers. You know, for every 4 pitchers we go and get, let's make 3 of those guys that can locate the ball now, change speeds now, pitch down in the zone now, and make one of them a high-velocity guy with projectable stuff that might be 2, 3, 4 years out. So I'm not sure if the ratios are the same. I'm not sure that the philosophy is exactly the same because they don't consult me. We stay in touch, but, you know, honestly, I'm hands-off. It's none of my business. But anytime they've asked me for my opinion on anything since I've left, I will always help the Fighters any way I can.
All right. Well, what would you change to make, I guess, what would you do to improve Nippon professional baseball, if you could?
You know, that's a really tough one for me, John. First of all, I have to say, being 100% honest, culturally, I'm afraid I might say the wrong thing. You know, I have so much respect for the culture and the history of Japanese baseball. It's not that I would want to change that. What I would like to have change, and I don't mean to sidestep this question, I'm just going to change your question and hopefully give you an answer.
Okay.
What I would like to have changed in world baseball, especially from the American Japanese side, is I would like an opportunity for both ways to be a little bit more of a player's choice rather than a dictated opportunity for a team to put a bid in, so to speak. I think that there can be a better way of meshing the two cultures together for a trading and an exchange of talent. And I mean that both ways. I mean that if an organization over here has somebody that the Japanese are interested in and they're projected maybe to be on the 40-man roster, or you're toying with the possibility of taking them off the 40-man, then give them an opportunity to acquire that player in the same way that an American team would acquire a player, or at least be in some type of bidding process for the player in Japan.
I got you. That sounds good. That's good. Now, you've been out of Japan for, what, more than 5 years now. So do you ever think you'll be returning here, and do you use anything that you learned in Japan, or something that you picked up in Japan, do you use it with the Dodgers now?
I think you use, from every baseball season, one to the next, regardless of where you are, I think you draw on your experiences. I probably draw on my Japanese experience more than I do any other frame time, and this is going to be my 29th year of professional baseball. So I think those 5 years in Japan I draw from all the time, and most probably it's from a patient standpoint, because I reflected a lot more in Japan in the moment than I did at any point in time over here. And it was always from a standpoint of, now, wait a minute, slow your mind down a little bit, and let's try to look at this in a different light. Because for whatever reason, this is not jiving right now. So stop using your Western mindset and just thinking you're immediately right, because that's the way you've always done it. And let's try to take a look at it from his or their perspective. So I actually do that in dealing with players with the Dodgers all the time. If my idea and my presentation is not matching up with something, you can immediately, most of the time, see that in their reaction and in their eyes. And if that's happening, I try to say, hey, help me understand, you explain to me what you're thinking, and we'll see if we can get on the same page. So many things from being in Japan, I think, have been extremely beneficial to me in my coaching career, into Kansas City managing, and then on to the Dodgers and being the bench coach.
So you think you'll be back in Japan in the future? You think it's a possibility, or probably not?
No, I think that's a possibility, provided that the time matches up personally for us as a family. Our son now is in his first full year of college. He's a collegiate baseball player at UT Arlington. Our daughter has 2.5 more years of high school. She's in her sophomore year. I can't see it happening before 2017, but 2017 on, if that happened to match up for what a Japanese team, preferably the Fighters. See, that's where I'm a little hesitant, because I want to clarify. I don't ever want my desires to cause anyone else harm. And I know the job that Oshima-san did, and I know the job that Okudayama-san is doing. I mean, for Pete's sakes, he takes him to the Japan Series his first year managing, never having managed. I mean, that's pretty good people skills and pretty good X's and O's and making the move at the right time and Jokyo Hundan and all that good stuff. So he's obviously doing a very good job. But we'll see. You know, John, I, with my faith and my spiritual convictions, if that's supposed to happen, God will work that out in his time. And the bottom line is this: I'll go where God calls me. And if he calls us back to Japan, that would be just fine with us.
Okay. All right. Last question. Now, would you just do me one favor and promise me the Dodgers will finally win it all this year? Can you do that for me?
Oh man, I wish I could promise you that.
Not a big request at all.
I tell you what, obviously with new ownership, the expectations are extremely high. And I will say this, at the end of the season last year, I personally have never been in a locker room with that much collective ability. Now, the teams that I was with in Japan had a lot of ability, and those guys are still, without a doubt, my favorite because of what we did together. But this group that I get to go to spring training with and work for Donnie and be the bench coach for, this is definitely the most talented. And I can tell you this, John, if we don't make it deep into the playoffs or make it to the playoffs and deep into the playoffs, and you want to do this again this time next year, I probably will not be talking to you as the Dodgers bench coach. The expectations are very high.
I know it. Don't I know it? All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you so much. We appreciate it. And we hope the Dodgers do well. And we hope to see you soon. We'll be looking for you on TV over here on NHK.
All right. Thanks, man. Tell everybody in Japan I said hello.
All right. We will do. All right, Trey. Thanks again so much for taking the time to chat with us.
Yeah, buddy. I sent him an email when I heard it. And I had to, you know, Trey plays the guitar. And he's from Texas, and when I listened to the audio for the first time on my iTunes, when the interview ends, it clicks into another random selection from my iTunes library. It was Merle Haggard playing My Old Guitar, and it sounded like I thought you had added it to the track to give Trey a little, you know, out, send off there. But it was perfect. I had to tell him that.
So. Oh, okay. You thought I added what?
Merle Haggard.
Myrtle?
A Merle Haggard. Whoa.
Yeah. If I even knew who that was, I think I'd be shot.
Let's just talk and we'll get to what you're used to doing.
All right. What stood out for you?
Well, let's see. I think the big thing was, there's a couple of things. I love the analysis of Kensuke and Yu Darvish, particularly Kensuke because he's going to the Giants. And it was something I had never heard him tell me before. Trey and I have talked a lot in the past, but that was new for me. Darvish, we talked about all the time, so less so. I think he's right about Tanaka, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. Yu Darvish, you know, he told me a year and a half ago that he expected him to be a top of the rotation guy, and that looks to be about right on. I remember going into the 2005 season saying his best pitcher on his team was a guy who would be having trouble getting out of Double A, and he was referring to Yu Darvish. But of course, at that time, he was 19 years old.
Right, right.
So Darvish has come a long way since that time. About the fighters, I think that was fairly interesting. And you know, this is a subject near and dear to my heart because the fighters are quite a different club than the mold, the NPB mold. That if you've read Bob Whiting's books, you have an image of what a prototypical Japanese team is like, and that they're all a little different. They all have their own character, but the fighters are the ones that really don't fit that mold very well. Mm-hmm. And the key phrase that I loved is Trey says, the fighters allowed us to put in place. Now, something to me, that is the difference. Now, when Trey was in 2003, the fighters hired Trey, and it was an okay season. In 2004, they did okay, and they reached the playoffs. 2004, the Marines hired Bobby Valentine back, and they improved. And all of a sudden, everybody and their foreign cousin wanted a foreign manager. But here's what happened. The fighters allowed him and allowed the people who were there to put a new system in place. In the case of the Hiroshima Carp, particularly, and the Oryx Buffaloes, particularly with Marty Brown and Terry Collins, that was not the case. They said put a new system in place, and then they basically kept the old system in place and added the manager on the front like a hood ornament.
Right. Here, you stand here and do this.
Exactly.
And that, don't do anything else.
Right. And that will change the look of the team and change the whole tenor of the team without actually having to change anything. And it's no surprise, really, that Terry walked away from that into and has become quite successful with the Mets. Terry's a guy who loves baseball, and Marty loves baseball. These guys love baseball. You know, it's you can't stand there and talk to them without, you know, baseball just you know, coming out of them somewhere.
Some of it gets on you, yeah.
Exactly. So in the Marines' case, it was that Bobby was has such an aura and is such a I guess an iconic figure, you know, love him or hate him. He's bigger than life, and they gave him the reins of the organization. Unfortunately, there were a lot of issues with that. They gave it to him, and they didn't really want to give it to him, but they did, and the Marines benefited in many ways from that, and he built a big brand. Now, here's the thing. Here's the irony in all this. 2003, 2004, basically, the fighters came to Trey in the springtime and said, Trey, here's your contract for next year. 2005, they said, Trey, here's your contract for excuse me, 2004 and 2005. He arrived in 2003. So 2006, the fighters are going absolutely nowhere. I saw them play. I'll never forget. I saw them play, and they were getting their heads beat in, but on the scoreboard, but watching them play, you could see they were playing well. They were just absurdly unfortunate in that, you know, good pitches were getting hit, and they were hitting the ball. They were getting decent swings and having some pretty good at bats that were not going their way. And when you watched it, you got the feeling this is a pretty decent team. Mm-hmm. They're just not winning. Well, the fact that they weren't winning told the fighters basically. Decided that they were going to get rid of Trey Hillman. And this is probably in May 2006. Mm-hmm. Now, how is that? That was the first year they won the Pacific League. So as for the, you know, the forward thinking, the fighters are forward thinking, but you know, it's hard to take the boy out of the country. Right. And basically somebody in the organization decided they were going to dump Trey. And when he won the Japan series, they couldn't. So they fired the pitching coach, mm-hmm. Mike Brown, who'd had a great deal of success with them. And so it was really weird. But the fighters were really about a heartbeat away from not being – I think if Trey goes in 2006, mm-hmm. the fighters go back to being essentially the Oryx Buffaloes.
Or the cookie-cutter Japanese.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Think how close they came to being – ordinary and ugly.
Yeah.
Instead of being what Trey would like to say, a beautiful thing.
Yeah. You know, I what stood out for me is the way he broke down as far as them bringing in new talent, how they draft, because that helped them deal with injuries, which are inevitable, right? You always end up with injuries, especially on the pitching staff.
Right.
And when he talked about guys who can locate and function with the, you know, within the team philosophy immediately. Right. And how they can work them into games while keeping the scores close. Because it sounded to me like, okay, we know that we're going to bring a guy out there. We don't expect him to put zeros on the scoreboard. What we want him to do is be consistent, keep the ball in certain zones, and whatever happens, happens. But most of the time, if he keeps the ball where we want him to, and he can do those things without getting too nervous, we're going to get decent enough results that we can move on in the game. And so, yeah, I actually wanted to ask the parameters of what he called now pitchability, mm-hmm. which I guess is immediate impact.
Right.
I guess, you know, there are different ways to say it. But he gave us an idea of obviously being able to keep the ball in certain zones. And
And
I have to believe that velocity and secondary stuff and things like that are all on the list.
Right.
As well, but you really got a sense that they don't expect these guys to go out and to strike guys out or to put up zeros consistently. They just need them to do certain things and keep working to get better. And that experience and that confidence while they're introducing into the level of competition,
mm-hmm.
all that stuff that they put into the draft. I mean, that was kind of fascinating for me. And especially when he said, you know, let's get three guys we can take now and put on the field and one guy who's a project.
Right. I remember having, again, we had a long interview in the, at the start of the 2006 season, I believe, and he had said, or 2005, I don't recall. It was 2006 because we were talking about Yagi, and Yagi being Rookie of the Year in 2006, and talking about somebody the team said could pitch now. Well, what I'm sure they probably intended that he would be able to pitch after now, but it turned out he hasn't. He pitched 2006, and it's pretty been lights out in the wrong way since then.
Yeah, yeah, he was able to pitch then.
Exactly. One year wonder right now. And talk about the Fighters becoming the Oryx Buffaloes.
Well, I also like how he talked about drafting players at the best available player at whatever position of need they have. So they do. I mean, I thought, you know, I look at the draft, and like I've always complained before, it's not really a draft when the person you're choosing has the right to say no.
Well, then the Major League draft isn't a draft either, because they can say no as well.
There are a lot of different factors, but it's hard to compare. Yeah, it's hard to compare these drafts. But
well, it is, because the difference is not that they can say no, because that's the same. The difference is that you can't select a guy in the first round and have him be yours, period. You have to wait and see who else wants to negotiate with him and then take him in a lottery.
Right.
And if you and here's the other fundamental difference is that if you do pick somebody and they do say no, you get nothing. In the majors, you get a compensation draft the following year.
Right. And we talked about this on a past show.
Sure.
I think it was a year and a half ago. But it seems like they're actually drafting for competitive balance, which we talked about was maybe not the particular goal of the way the draft is set up here in Japan. But it sounds like, and I guess you can ask Shimada-san if they are still using the process that Trey helped put in place.
Well, I think that was input Trey had. He has admitted to me that he doesn't have really anything to do with the actual draft. He doesn't know the guys who are being drafted. And Shimada told me that that Yoshimura, the fellow that Trey mentioned and who I've known for, going on 16, 17 years now, since he worked in the Pacific League office, is a key part to preparing all this. They build a big body of data and scouting reports for the scouting director,
mm-hmm.
who will make the general manager. I don't remember who's making the decision. And then the general manager will say, no, I got a feeling about this guy. We're going to get him. And I'm guessing is that he had a feeling about Yuki Saito, and the Fighters were unlucky enough to get him. but his picks have been, you know, his picks have been pretty good. And well, the Fighters have an outstanding record in pulling names out of a hat, because they got, Sugano didn't work out, but they got Yuki Saito, and he hasn't worked out either, but they got Yo Daikong to our Japanese listeners, and so on. So it's interesting. They have this great system, but Trey always said that, you know, that I think that was his side of the story, and how it's implemented is the side that he said he really didn't get too involved with. I think that was a kind of a turf thing. He didn't want, you know, he won't step on somebody's toes.
Hey, a case can be made for Yuki Saito pitching above his potential. So, I mean,
sure,
it's probably it was a bad pick, but they've squeezed the most out of it. But anyway,
boy, that's not saying much.
That's not saying much, but I like the way that they draft. Obviously, getting Shohei Ohtani in the offseason was a big deal, and we saw that he was moved up to the first team. I'm not sure if he's going to make the club for the beginning of the season, but it looks like they have him on a tight schedule, and I think that schedule includes him working with the first team, so I wouldn't be surprised if he makes the team out of spring. But anyway, yeah, I give Trey a lot of credit, a ton of credit. I don't think he wants to take a lot of it, and that's just the way he is, and that's fine. But I think part of his legacy was that the fact that after he left, the team continued to win.
Yep.
And he credited Kuriyama with helping bring the team to get the team to the Pacific League Championship, into the Japan Series, and Jokyo Handan, which is reading situations and all that kind of stuff. But I give the whole staff and the whole organization more credit than I give the manager per se. I think everything was in place. I think that was a situation where, as long as you don't mess things up, I think you're going to be fairly successful. After that, he just ran into a team that was better in the Japan Series.
Well, yeah. I don't want to take anything away from Kuriyama. He's a lot, you know, I think he's a much smarter manager, or at least a much smarter in his role than he was as a player. He didn't strike me as being a particularly clever or analytical player when he was an outfielder with the Swallows. And Katsuya Nomura had a jab at him that Japanese baseball has gone downhill when a know-nothing like Kuriyama can win his league and go to the Japan Series. But that's just Katsuya Nomura. He doesn't give anybody the needle unless he actually kind of likes them. So,
oh, okay. I was going to say he barks at everybody first,
exactly.
and then bites them.
Okay, but I think that's probably inaccurate. I think Kuriyama is a plus, and he is his own man to some degree. But he came into a situation where his role is to be the field manager and to be a source of input into team policy and team direction, but not to be a decision maker off the field. Now, this is an American-type manager, and this is what the Fighters wanted, and a lot of Japanese managers like that, but nobody really does it. They want the manager sort of to be the fall guy mm-hmm. for everything that goes wrong with their teams, because the front office will stay and the manager will go. And they needed a guy who didn't have to be a control freak.
Yeah.
So, and in that respect, you know, I think that's a talent. I think Kuriyama is a real smart guy. I think he's wrong about Yuki Saito, but heck, so he's got to make a decision. He's made a decision, and all in all, his decisions are working out.
All right. Well, let's hope that Trey's decisions work out with the Dodgers, and they bring home that World Series that will. Hey. We're keeping it in the division. You got to think that way.
That's John's thinking. Keep it in the division. Well, you know what? My thinking is this. If the Giants don't win, now that my best friend is a Dodgers fan, I want the Dodgers to win.
You see, folks, he's looking downward. He's leaning forward. His heart's not in it. But anyway, hey, by the way, I want to thank
you. You can't see it in my heart, buddy. You know what's there. You don't have to tell people what you see because you're telling them lies.
All right.
I'm trying to be funny.
I want to thank Deanna Rubin for her question, which was the one about drawing on his experience from Japan and how he uses that and implements that in the States. She sent that question in to us, so thank you very much. And hopefully we will have Trey on the show next year as a world champion bench coach.
Well, good luck, Trey.
All right. Now let's talk about the WBC. The rosters have all been set now, sort of. I was looking online until the last moment.
They're
set now. I saw that they were updated, but it didn't really give me enough time to go through them the way I wanted to. But let's talk about Japan's first of all.
Sure.
A number of guys were dropped, and someone teased me that most of the guys dropped were Chunichi Dragons, and I'm like,
that was Deanna.
She didn't tease me. It was somebody at work. But
okay.
Asao was injured. Oshima had a bad elbow early on in camp, and he figured not to be there. So those two guys, I understand. Yamai, I didn't think he really had good stuff. In fact, during the week, I put something on the Facebook page and asked people, and I actually was looking at an older roster, so I didn't have the updated roster. So I had guys like Tanishige on the drop zone, but he had already been dropped. But Daisuke Yamai, I said, you know, he doesn't have shutdown stuff. He doesn't throw all that hard. He's really not an elite pitcher, so I didn't really think he was going to stick around either. I mean, this is a team that had Naoyuki Shimizu throwing for it in the 2009 tournament, so I suppose anybody could get on and get an inning or an out here and there. So anyway, Shuichi Murata was dropped, and Hijirisawa, and I always mess up his name because it's so long, but Hijirisawa was dropped, and that's the one that really got to me, because I could not for the life of me figure out why they kicked him out. He's a guy you can use to bring in to shore up the defense late in games. He can steal bases for you. He can run for guys. Versatile guy. He can play all the outfield positions, so you don't really have to worry about where to play him. I know we talked to Dave DeFreitas a long time ago, and we know that he runs some bad routes to ball sometimes, but if he's in a corner outfield position, I don't think it's a big deal. I really don't understand that one. Ginjiro Sumitani, the need for three catchers, I think, is kind of ridiculous, and he's just going to sit there And I like him. You know, Ginchan's a good guy, but do you really need three catchers? I mean, you got one in Abe who hits from the left side, and he's going to play most of the time anyway. You got another guy who hits from the right side. They're both veteran catchers.
Here's the thing, is that they can call up somebody. You know, it's not like and they're going to be playing. And here's the other thing. They're going to be playing in Japan. So they call up somebody. He can be there that day. So do they need three catchers? They might need it if they go to San Francisco, but they certainly don't need three catchers at Tokyo Dome.
I mean, in terms of the roster,
right.
You can only change pitchers and catchers, and that's if you ascend to the next round. So let's say Abe gets injured.
Yeah, somebody's hurt. If somebody's hurt, they can be replaced.
Right, but only after that round.
Oh, okay.
And so,
I guess to make that fair for the teams who aren't playing in their home country.
I suppose so, because yeah, they, you know, you wouldn't have to cross the international date line to get there.
Right, right.
So yeah, I thought Nomi was in the drop zone. I thought he was a bubble guy who's not going to start, and he's not really great as a reliever, but he seemed to do well.
Yeah.
Coming out of the bullpen, so I'm not so concerned about him.
I'm not concerned about. The only pitchers who concern me right now are Wakui, Maeda.
Because he's injured?
Apparently he is. He's got a bad shoulder. And Masahiro Tanaka, who really hasn't done anything yet. So he's not bad, but he's not good. Yeah. So those three are the ones. Basically, the rest of the guys look from pretty good to really good.
I'm with you, except I had Otonari in the drop zone. For me, I didn't think he was going to be great as a reliever. I didn't really know what his...
They're going to use him as a starter, I think. I think he's going to end up as a starter.
Yeah, I think so, too. But I think I would start him. I would have him come on in the game. I wouldn't have him start the game.
Okay.
And I heard somebody in the WBC or someone from the States talking about how they're going to have double starters anyway. Guys,
this is what you have to do. Because,
four innings, yeah.
Right, because of the pitch limitations. I think it's 65 pitches in the first round and 65 or 70 in the second or something to that effect.
Yeah.
But it's you can't really depend on one guy going seven or eight innings. It's going to be four innings or five innings at the most. And Koji said that basically right now he wanted his starters to get, you know, his big pitchers to give him 50 pitches. And hopefully they'll try to get him out in the inning before they get, you know, so that he doesn't want to change horses in the middle of the stream, which is one of the smart things I've... He says smart things now and then. I guess he's a human being, and that's his right.
Now, Kazuo Matsui, I don't know why he's on the team other than to be one of those guys who has seen some of these major league players, might know a couple tendencies here and there, can help give some words of advice from the bench, but I really don't think he should be in any games, and... He's not the kind of guy, you know, Koji Yamamoto said he wanted guy. He thought about balance. He thought about where runs are going to be at a premium. But then he brings in a Kazuo Matsui who's going to, even if he helps you at the plate, he might hurt you so much defensively that you end up giving up runs. I don't get it. It doesn't make sense.
Well, a lot doesn't make sense because, in fact, the whole premise of the team was that I'm going to name a bunch of guys – and they'll be healthy, and then we'll pick the best of the bunch. But what he did was he didn't name enough guys so that when people started to drop out from injuries, you know, and the story is right now that the Dragons basically called up Yamamoto and said, bring back Yamai and bring back Asao and bring back Oshima because we're not going to let him play for you. And then what the Carp should have done is said, bring back Maeda. But the story is because Kenjiro Nomura, the Carp manager, was Yamamoto was his first manager in NPB.
Mm-hmm.
And he can't say no to Yamamoto. So basically they're letting this is the story. Now, I don't know if he's hurt, if it was a twinge. He said I believe Kenta Maeda, when he said his shoulder felt fine on Wednesday, but Sunday he basically said, it kind of doesn't really hurt.
Yeah. And you could see him squinting. I mean, they played this practice game last week and you could see he was squinting after some pitches.
He was throwing, most of his fastballs, barely hit 130 kph. So he's, I mean, normally he's about 142.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah, there was some concern there, and they said, you know, I saw a newspaper article that in which Koji Yamamoto said, hey, look, we're not going to push guys, we're not going to try to make them do something that they can't do at this time, but then you have a guy who's injured and you don't take him on the roster.
So I know. I know exactly, but this is the kind of illogic that has almost powered this Japanese team. You know, you pick too few guys for the roster and then you complain about not having enough. And I understand that the people who were dropped basically were grumbling about this fact that there weren't enough people in camp, and there was no, you know, they can call people back at the end of the round, and this is it. There's sort of this hard-headed push to move forward and cut the ties, almost like cutting ties with reality. This is our group. We're not going to ask for anybody else. Yeah. We're not going to need anybody else. This is our team. It's all been about this sort of like mythical team unity, fighting spirit kind of thing. Yeah. These are our guys. We've been abandoned by our major leaguers. We're going to fight it all alone. We're going to fight it without the rest of NPB behind us. Yeah. It's just bizarre. And that's pretty much just, I think, Yamamoto. I don't think anybody else. He's got almost like he's got something to prove that he doesn't have to prove, that nobody
exactly.
cares about.
That's how I've been feeling about most of the time when I see him talk and I see him on the news. He's like, this is my baby. I'm in charge. That's the attitude. That's the kind of persona that I'm seeing from him. And it doesn't need to be that way. It's a group thing. I mean, this is Japan. It's a group society. But I'm really not happy with the outfield. I think it's slow. I think it's old. I mean, Kakunaka playing in the outfield, no, that's never a good idea. He's really not that great a defensive player. Uchikawa made some plays before, but I mean, in general, he's not a plus outfielder. He's maybe average to maybe a little bit below average. But he made some plays before, and I think they have those things. But that was 4 years ago. I mean,
well, Uchikawa is a gamer, and I think it's hard to deny that. Chono is kind of a trouble for me in center field. It's not that he isn't a good center fielder, because I think at you know, towards the second half of last season, he looked really, really good. Mm. But here's the thing. He's got a good arm, and that's why he's in center. But this ball is causing him some frustration, and his throws on Wednesday gave me some concern. Hijidisawa was on base, and I think Shuichi Murata exploited Chono's throws, because I guess they knew he wasn't going to – basically the rule right now is don't throw the ball away, as opposed to you have a chance to prevent a run, a key run, mm-hmm. don't throw the ball away and make things worse.
Right.
So both of Chono's throws with runners trying to take extra bases were lollipops. You know, they were howitzer mortar rounds, you know, big high arcing throws that were on target. That were going to be easy to catch.
Mm.
So that was a concern. But they basically, anyway, so yeah, having basically, Itoi can play center and that doesn't bother me. If Itoi's in center, they're just as good, but Itoi's arm is better. I think they want him in right. To me, that makes sense. But on the other hand, if you have, now I'm not a proponent. I like Ryohei Hisawa. But right now he's still a work in progress as an offensive player. Defensively, I would love to have him on the team.
Well, that's what I meant. That's what I was saying. Hey, bring him in as a defensive replacement, pinch runner kind of a guy. Just that speed.
Yeah.
I don't think he has to start. I didn't really see him as a starter, but I didn't. I don't also see Matsui as a starter. But
no,
Matsui, what are you going to bring him in to do? I think he's one dimensional. I think he's going to come in and hit. Maybe if you have to put him in the field, you do it, but you
sure.
do it reluctantly, because it's not that he's going to improve your defense anywhere.
Well, you can bring him in to hit, and he can cover a hole at second base. They don't need him to cover a hole short, because they've got, I think, five shortstops on the roster.
Yeah.
But,
well, that was another thing I wanted to touch on is all these. Well, Sakamoto hasn't really been in good form, and I'm not sure that he's 100% healthy. But you look at the infield, and probably the starting infield is Sakamoto at short, Toritani
yep.
at second, Matsuda at third, and
yep.
Inaba at first base.
Yep.
That's an average of 31-ish for the age, but you have two old guys, oldish guys, and then two, well, I guess,
they're young.
Yeah. You have one young guy. I mean, Matsuda's 29, Toritani's 31.
One guy is past his prime, who's just past his prime, Toritani, and two guys who are still quite young.
And then you got a Derek Jeter aged guy as a backup, and Ibata, he's 37. I mean, where's he going to play? I mean, he's good, and I no doubt.
Ibata is a tremendously underrated player, basically because, first of all, I think he's an underrated player. I think he's a gamer. I think he's a smart guy. I think this is a guy you really want. I really like the inclusion of Ibata. In the sense that he can come in, he doesn't have the ability to be a tremendous hitter over a season, but I think he has a tremendous ability to be a hitter in a short tournament.
Yeah,
and in a clutch situation, there are a few players on the team I would rather have batting in an important situation than Ibata, just because he's so smart and so cool. Calm.
Cool under pressure. Okay, well, we'll see. I mean, I'm not happy exactly with the roster, but I think Japan's pitching, and we talked about this, I think, on the last show. They talk about how there are no major league players, you know, the Darvishes, the Ichiros, and all those guys. You know, they played in the WBC, some of them before they went over to the United States, so they were budding major leaguers, and I think we have a lot of budding major leaguers out there for this team now. My lineup would go like this, and you say anybody can make up a lineup, but I would put my lineup like this.
You mean a bat? No, anybody can make
sorry,
a batting.
Sorry, batting order. Chono, Toritani, Inaba, then Abe, Nakata Sho. I know they've been grooming him for part somewhere in the heart of the order, so I think number five hole is where he's going to go. Matsuda, Uchikawa, Itoi, and Sakamoto batting nine.
Yeah, why? The question for me is Koji Yamamoto's love affair with the Shonakata. I wouldn't be surprised if somebody catches them in a hotel together.
Yikes. Going there, are we?
Because there's no reason this guy should be on the team, yeah, other than he gives you a guy with the most home run potential, but he swings and misses a lot. He gets bad swings. He has a good arm. I'll tell you this. He's a pretty respectable outfielder. I do like him.
Yeah.
He's become a respectable outfielder, and he's got a cannon. So do I not like him? I just can't stand having him as a starter because he's just a zero. He's probably the worst. Right now, he's the worst offensive player on that team other than Ginjiro Tsumitani.
Yeah. He's not doing much, and I think they're just gonna hand him a bat and say go hit, and I think he's gonna play anyway. So
well, yeah. If it were me, I'd keep him on the bench, and then when you need a home run at the late innings, here's a guy who has the best chance of giving you that home run
on a fastball down the middle.
Well, yeah, or hang a curveball. So whatever. But people make mistakes, and he'll be there to cash in on them. But you know, that's if one run's going to win the game and it's two outs at the bottom of the ninth, and you know you've got the number nine guy coming up, you've got eight and nine coming up, and you know you have a choice between him or Ibata or Kazuo Matsui. Okay, give Nakata get a bat. Yeah. But Koji's going to do what Koji's going to do, and we just have to see. You know, hope that like Sadaharu Oh, who I love, but is a terrible big game manager. You know. Things break right for him.
I have lost confidence after seeing this roster, but I still think Japan's going to do well. Now let's talk about. Now we picked our teams that we're going to advance out of round one. Let's talk about round two. I have the Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico advancing out of Miami.
Okay.
And I have Japan and Cuba advancing from the Tokyo round.
Right now I've. In Miami, the four teams I think we're going to see, U.S., Canada, Dominican Republic, and Venezuela. Now, as much I like Puerto Rico because I know more guys on the Puerto Rico team than I do on the – I don't think I know anybody on the Dominican team this time. So I'd pull in for them. I'd love to see them in San Francisco, but I don't think they're going to make it. I think out of Miami, we're going to see the Dominican Republic finish first. Although they have a terrible history in this tournament, they make a lot of errors.
Yeah, they've been bad.
They throw a lot of bad pitches. They miss a lot of breaking balls at this time of the year. It's really hard to see them finishing first. I mean, they got beat by the Netherlands for Christ's sakes twice last time. I mean, they got beat twice by the Kingdom of the Netherlands. Think about that. I guess it's hard. You know, you have to be able to improve on that. So I'm gonna pick them to win Miami, and I'm gonna pick Japan to win in Tokyo, and Korea to come in second. I think Cuba. The thing about Cuba is everybody likes Cuba because of all the major leaguers who come out of Cuba. But and I do like the Cuban manager, Victor Mesa. I think he's a real sharp guy. I liked a lot of the things I saw in November, but I think Cuba, it's going to be, I think playing in Tokyo, here's two things, and here's why I picked Korea, because nobody is motivated to play in this tournament like Korea. And the reason why, and this is something none of the other 11 teams can compete with, is that if they get to San Francisco, every young player on the Korean team will not have to go through hell in the Korean military because they will be exempt from the draft.
Okay.
They will be exempt from compulsory service.
That's always a good
That is a massive
That's always
motivator.
A good, you good
think,
motivator.
You right. think they're going to lose in Tokyo? Yeah, think again.
All right.
Okay, so I think it's going to be Japan because they're playing at home. I think it's going to be Korea because they're motivated. They're going to get to San Francisco. Now, what's going to happen? Now you have the Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, Cuba, and Japan. How do you see that finishing out?
I've got, and this is probably a hard pick, I've got the Dominican Republic winning it all.
Okay.
And I obviously want to see the U.S. do well, but I already had them dropping out, so unfortunately, okay. I don't have them in the final. It'd be nice if they were there, and if they don't win it, I think I would like to see the Dominican Republic win. But since we don't have much time left in the podcast, I was gonna pick Venezuela because I know they have a lot of talent, and I thought they were gonna be really good. But they had so many guys back out, and they have such a lack of pitching that I just can't see them moving on all the way.
Okay.
Korea, yeah, we know that they're motivated and everything, and they always do well in this tournament, and they probably start earlier in terms of training than anybody else. But if we're going to finish the podcast and get to the listener question, we're going to have to move on. So,
okay, well, do I get to pick?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to pick U.S. to beat Japan in the first game in San Francisco on an umpire's decision. I'm going to pick South Korea to beat the Dominican Republic and for South Korea to beat the United States in the final and to finally win it after two heartbreaking losses in which they were essentially the best team in 2006 and didn't make the final and lost in extra innings to Japan. So good luck to South Korea.
All right. Moving along. We have three players that we're going to focus on who are going over to the States for the first time this season, and that's Hiroyuki Nakajima, who's with the A's, Kyuji Fujikawa with the Chicago Cubs, and Kensuke Tanaka with the Giants. And I asked on the Facebook page this week who's going to probably have the biggest impact. I got mixed responses, but basically everybody's picking Nakajima because it's by default, because he's probably going to get the starting job out of spring training.
That's almost the best one. I think, yeah, you have to say anybody's got a job. It's like if you've got a job, you have a good chance to be Rookie of the Year. So he's got a job. Half the battle is won. Now, I like Kensuke because he doesn't have a job, but the guy who has it is maxing out his career at the age of 37 or 38. So I think Kensuke is going to start the season, and here's the question. Does he make the adjustments? He has a chance. If he makes the adjustments, then he'll finish the season like Norichika Aoki did and be the San Francisco Giants' best second baseman at the end of the season.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I think I actually that was going to be my argument was a guy who's 37, and we saw Derek Jeter at 37 last year injure himself on a pretty innocuous play where there's nobody around him. He's just fielding a ground ball and he breaks his ankle. And those kinds of things happen to 37-year-old shortstops. I don't know what the track record is for these guys, but I don't think it's a good one. So I think it was second baseman, Marcos Scudero. I think that we can assume that at some point he's not going to be out there. And all Tanaka has to do is make the roster.
Right.
And if he can do that, he can. And if he can stay sharp, he'll get a chance. And I think if he gets a chance, he's going to be productive. Nakajima, I think I remember at the 2009 WBC, a lot of the scouts and the WBC people were saying how great he played defensively, and I'm like, no, that's really not the case.
Well, he is playing on grass too, so. This is something he'll have to get used to, but it's something that you can get used to. Although it helps if you're getting used to it when you're 23 years old instead of 30. I guess he's 28, 30. So same thing with Tanaka, but I think Nakajima is going to surprise people. He hit like crazy in the last WBC.
Yeah, and I think his bat is going to be ahead of his glove, and he's going to hit. I think it's all going to come down to how he functions in that role of shortstop. And
I think he's a below average major league shortstop, which isn't a bad thing. I mean,
there are many of them across the major leagues who stay on because of their bats.
Well, no, I'm saying that if you're a below average major league shortstop, you're better than almost everybody else other than, six or seven, 10 guys.
Right.
Okay, you're a lot better than the guy coming out of AAA doesn't know what he's doing. He's in that level. He's not going to be one of the best guys. He'll make the routine plays. He'll look really good sometimes. He can hit. Okay, I think I like him. Fujikawa. Now, Japanese pitchers have made the transition to the majors fairly well, but most of them are funky types. You know, they're Nomo or they're they've got odd looks, and they've got unusual pitches.
Takatsu.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, or, Iwakuma's kind of a unique pitcher. I mean, these guys are all a little unique, but
Tateyama, yeah.
But here you've got Fujikawa. What's strange about him other than his hair?
His hair. Oh, you beat me.
And, you can't get people out with that. So they've seen it all. I mean, I don't see Fujikawa being successful. Who knows? I wish him the best because I think he's a wonderful guy, and I wish him the best. So.
Yeah, we know that Carlos Marmol has struggled with control every year he's been in the big leagues. So it's not a matter of if, but when Fujikawa gets a chance. But as I said last year, if he can't keep people off of his fastball, they're not going to swing at his forkball, and he'll have to throw pitches over the plate, and those will be souvenirs sooner than you can think. So I don't see him as a 30 save or 30 hold guy, but maybe he can have some success. But again, the wind blowing out at Wrigley, not a good thing. All right, let's go to fielding questions. All right, we got one question that just beat the deadline last night. It's from Dave, and he says, there was a recent Japan baseball card set published that featured famous gaijin players.
Right.
It got me wondering if there has ever been a gaijin catcher in Japan. And for this, I talked to Michael Westbay, who's this year doing his own show called the Pro Yaku Report. You can find that on the JapaneseBaseball.com homepage. Now, he actually did a couple of shows on this, and he's done some research, and he found that there were 8 regular catchers and 8 fill-in guys. And there have been a number of second-generation Japanese players who have caught. And I saw that you as well, Jim, made a list.
There were, and some Korean guys who were Korean nationals, but I haven't included them. So.
Yeah, so I don't know if this is all, but we had a list of 16 guys.
Wow.
Including one-game wonder guys. So
okay.
I will send you this list, Dave, since we're running out of time. We don't want to run too long. But I think Charlie Lewis is probably the most well-known of these foreign catchers?
No, I think Bucky Harris was the first because he was one of the original guys in Japanese pro baseball. When the current league structure was first, the predecessor was put in place in 1936, Harris McGaillard was caught for 3 years in Japan. So he was probably the most famous of them. Charlie Lewis played a couple of years in Japan. First of 3 Lewises in Japan. Mm-hmm. Who are the others? You should know the others.
I saw it, but I didn't read it, so I don't know the others.
Colby?
Oh, Colby. You mean overall, all the Lewises? Oh, I don't know.
3 Lewises in Japan.
Well, isn't Fred Lewis in here?
He is too. You've got the other one. So Charlie Lewis, and then 40 years later, Colby Lewis, and now Fred Lewis. Okay.
All right. Good for me.
Good for you.
But yes, there have been a number. I will send you this list, Dave, and I will also post this at the bottom of our the post that goes under the podcast. All right. So thank you so much for the question, Dave. And everyone, listen, your opinions and your inquiries make the show. So
absolutely.
We encourage more from everyone, including MP3s.
Yep. We want to hear your voice instead of ours.
Or Jim's. Ours for ours.
Indeed.
All right. Send them to yakyujohn@gmail.com and we'll play them on the show. You can also leave us a comment or question on the Facebook page. And Jim's on Twitter, and I'm on Twitter at DYBaseball.
So I'm on Twitter at JBallAllen.
So hit us up there as well. Thank you very much. We will be back in 2 weeks, and we'll talk to you then, right in the middle of the WBC. It's going to be great.
Yep.
All right. Enjoy your baseball.
Enjoy the WBC, babe.